My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome to episode 7 of Mysteries and Monsters. Firstly, thank you for the kind comments we received for the show so far. We're glad to know people are enjoying our interviews and the subjects we're covering, so it really does mean a lot, so thank you, it is appreciated. If there's any subjects or people you'd like us to cover or interview, let us know by leaving us a message on the Mysteries and Monsters Facebook page or via email at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. A big thank you again to Brennan and Ian at the Ghost Story Guys podcast for being so nice about us on their latest episode. I'll have to send you something in for your next episode of listener stories. And if you haven't checked that podcast out, you can find them at the Ghost Story Guys podcast on most podcast aggregators. This week, I'm joined by the filmmaker Alexander Petikoff. Alex has had a lifelong interest in cryptids, and we discuss his body of work so far, his work with the Small Town Monsters crew, and his upcoming film, Lions of the East, focusing on big cat sightings in New England. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube and Instagram, rate and review us on your podcast app, and thanks again for listening. Now it's time for this week's interview. So today I'm joined by filmmaker Alexander Petikoff, a fellow lover of cryptids. He's recently directed the Small Town Monsters series On the Trail of Champ, and he's currently working on a tantalising new documentary entitled Lions of the East, which looks into the reports of mountain lions and mystery big cats in the New England area. Alexander, welcome.
How you doing, Paul? Thanks for having me.
Oh, very welcome. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. So how's things? All right?
Yeah, very good. It's springtime here in New England, beautiful weather. Everything's coming to life, which includes a million different projects and events. Everyone's out of the winter hibernation, so it's been a very busy time and looks to be that way for the next month or so.
Ah, good. So let's kind of dive into it there. So as a filmmaker that's obviously got an interest in cryptids and monsters and wonderfully weird things, how did you end up making that decision as a filmmaker that's what you wanted to look into?
Right, well, I mean, like many people involved in sort of cryptozoology and the unknown, I was always an enthusiast. I was always interested in the subject. Ever since I was young, I grew up on the documentaries, you know, In Search of, the various Bigfoot documentaries, some of the classic kind of shows, Monster Quest, of course, Animal X, one of my favorites. So as a kid, I was always just kind of fascinated by that. And as I got older, you know, I kind of was more of an armchair researcher, was reading all the Lauren Coleman books, all the Meldrum stuff, everything you'd expect, Cryptomundo, all the blogs. And from there, once I got out of college, I kind of decided to start making my own documentaries on these subjects. It was something that I'd always thought about doing, but it didn't really dawn on me that I could go beyond being just that kind of armchair enthusiast or somebody that was interested in the subject. And I wanted to make my own history and my own kind of investigations in these subjects, and I thought filmmaking would have been a good way to tackle that, because you do a lot of research in it, get to go and visit the locations, you get to meet the people who are kind of the prominent researchers or the ones that are in the know about the local areas and the communities. And I thought overall it was kind of a good encapsulating way to tackle a mysterious subject.
Yeah, I think that's one of the aspects about this kind of field, that a lot of people just concentrate on the actual creature or monster or legend, but as you kind of mentioned there, it's the social impact, I think, of a lot of these stories that's quite interesting. And I think that's something that in your series that you did with the champ, there is that kind of wider picture of how it affects a community that has to deal with such a thing.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think it goes well beyond the monster itself. I mean, a lot of people get into it because they want to definitively prove there's a creature. I mean, of course, all of us that are into this are probably interested in that on some level, but I think it goes well beyond that. As a lover of history, a lot of the stories are just ingrained in local folklore. Just like somebody who perhaps doesn't know about cryptozoology might hear about the story of the vampire or the werewolf. Mm. You've got the story of the champ or the Bigfoot or whatever regional name it takes on. So it becomes part of a history of a region. And it's really interesting nowadays in the 21st century to see how that's kind of morphed into almost like cryptid tourism. I know that's a term that's starting to surface, which I think is really cool. And I'm definitely a big proponent of that. Love one of these thoughts and seeing, you know, the statues and what the local communities do. And I think preserving that is a pretty noble kind of thing. It's cool because it's mysterious, but there's still that human element to it. And I think a lot of these monsters are obviously driven by humans. I mean, you need people to see monsters and you need people to kind of propagate the stories and the local legends and that sort of thing. So yeah, definitely. It's very interesting in that aspect.
Yeah. When you get certain cases such as the Mothman, especially, is probably the one that seems to really be sort of tied to a specific area more than, you know, and obviously you've got Loch Ness because purely you've got a landlocked creature there. But I think that kind of aspect where you've got that additional surrounding situation, I've always, like you say, it gives you probably a bigger picture of the history of the particular area.
Yeah, definitely. I was just thinking about the Dover Demon even.
Yeah.
I think the answer of that is coming up just a couple days from now. And that's something that, you know, I work very close to that area, and I will probably drive down into the Springdale Avenue and Farm Street, the areas where the creature was seen. But if you think about it, that was a creature that was only seen for two nights. Mm. That's it. It's not sort of a large phenomenon like something more like Champ, where it has sightings and there's a longer history, or even regional Bigfoot stories, which have taken place across the world, essentially. Mm-hmm. The Dover Demon was one specific instance. And I think, you know, like Mothman, like some of the Flatwoods Monster, perhaps, there are more of these bizarre kind of cases that just pop up once and they sort of disappear. I mean, there really hasn't been anything like the Dover Demon since, but it's definitely one of the most notable cryptids in New England, if not all of sort of the paranormal, even, because I think it extends sort of beyond cryptozoology. A lot of people more into the UFO stuff might consider the Dover Demon to be something along those lines too.
Yeah, I think that's particularly because it was such a peculiarly described creature that I think more people would hope that it was alien rather than Earth-based, I think, because it's just such an unusual descriptive creature, because it's not the kind of thing that someone would make a mistake of some other creature, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the time when that happened in 1977, there wasn't the internet or anything like that, so you couldn't really get this information out. The only people that really investigated it were people like Lauren Coleman, and then sort of UFO researcher type stuff that was really in its early days. So I think that kind of amalgamation of characters created what we now know as the Dover Demon, and whatever else is there is kind of lost in history. Having been to the town of Dover, you know, I visited the library there and I started asking if they had any literature or anything like that on that subject. The only thing I could get was most towns in New England have a book kind of with the town history dating back to the colonial days, times of the settlers. And there was one page they had in the Dover Public Library about the town with the Dover Demon, and included one of the drawings of it. And it was just one singular page. Can you print this out for me? So that's about it. So everything else that we know about this subject was essentially just brought out to the public by the journalists, by people like Lauren Coleman and others. So very, very fascinating case. I hope to someday look into it in sort of greater detail while there's still some of the original eyewitnesses being alive.
And I think that's the other good thing kind of about the era that we're in at the moment, because for people like ourselves who find these stories and historical aspects as interesting as they are, the opportunities for with YouTube and sharing and Facebook and things like that now, is it's just connecting a whole new generation of people to kind of look back at some of these cases and perhaps give them a bit more bit more depth than perhaps there was allowed at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just, you know, being able to expand a little bit on that is really interesting. And I think we're at a time where you're able to get that information more readily and you can share this stuff, as you said, with the social media, with all the kind of streaming platforms, especially if we're talking about documentaries. It's a really good way to disseminate that information and get a lot of people interested. I know there's a lot of new people kind of getting into cryptozoology, and it seems like it's almost growing at the moment just because I think the world is so crazy that people are looking for sort of escape. And you have documentaries that are being produced that are, you know, very well received, that are portraying it to people who maybe are not familiar with the subject and getting them interested in it, which I think is really awesome. And, you know, we welcome people into this, and hopefully they'll share our enthusiasm as those of us who have been in it since we were kids. So, yeah.
Yeah, good luck with that, wherever they find. I was talking to somebody the other day. We were on about a specific subject. And I was just like, that's just a whole rabbit hole you just don't want to go down. Right. Once you discover certain subjects, and it's for somebody like me who lives in the UK, it's from that first moment I saw the Patty film that just changed my life.
Oh yeah, that's one of the things when I talk to people, especially with the Bigfoot subject, I often mention this. Usually people that are into the Bigfoot phenomena have had their own experience or fit into the camp of when they were younger, they either saw the Patterson-Gimlin film or they saw The Legend of Boggy Creek on TV or at a drive-in movie. So recently I visited the South and I went kind of on a southern monster sort of expedition from Falk to southern Louisiana, Honey Island Swamp Monster, that sort of thing. So it was really interesting to retrace that and kind of relive a little bit of that history, because a town like Falk, it's a small town in the middle of Arkansas. There's probably hundreds of towns just like it across Arkansas, but for whatever reason, this one town has this myth that brings thousands of people from across the world there every year, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, that was because I spoke to Lyle Blackburn a few episodes ago, and it's quite odd because that's one of the first of the films of those type that I remember watching. It was shown over here in the UK at about 6 o'clock in the evening, which for an unsuspecting 7-year-old was quite a shock, I can assure you.
Yeah, I mean, the way it was filmed was really interesting. Just the fact that it was kind of portrayed as a docudrama, and I understand it was one of the first films that was really pursuing that kind of depiction of using people who actually had experiences and kind of dramatizing their encounters, and it influenced a lot of filmmaking, and a lot of the sci-fi genre was influenced by this film, believe it or not. And I know Lyle and other people who have come after kind of the film and got involved in the research have really done the groundwork in showing that it's not just something that was in a movie in the 70s, that it's an ongoing kind of phenomenon. I think, of course, Seth's documentary too would fit right in with that. So it's such a fascinating mystery because you have this movie attached to it that really gave it its name, but there's so much more to it. And, you know, the movie's a classic. Like I said, most people I've talked to have been interested in the subject because of The Legend of Boggy Creek. And that's why I'm so excited about the upcoming remaster that Charles Pierce's daughter, Pamela, is doing.
Yeah.
It's going to be so incredible.
Yeah, it's been really it's been quite good to see, because I follow her, so I've seen a few things and obviously seen where the story's kind of come from over the last 18 months, and it's been quite a positive story for her and the family and getting that film back, but also I think it's generated a lot of new interest in it.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I've spoken to her about it. I was supposed to meet her in Falk when I was there, but some travel plans got rearranged, and I'm hoping to interview her in a couple weeks just for kind of my Sasquatch Out of the Shadows YouTube channel. Cool. Because I filmed with Lyle down there and some of their Southern Swamp Monsters. So I'll put out kind of a little kind of rougher documentary perhaps than some of the stuff that's more feature length that I'm doing. But just kind of stuff to get it out there, because I always am interested in the Bigfoot stuff, but she's mentioned how, you know, there's been a lot of new interest and a lot of people that are getting involved. And I think it's really cool because it's that classic monster movie. And at the time, you know, I don't think anybody really knew what impact it would have on the future. And obviously it did. And we wouldn't be talking about it today if it didn't kind of get beyond what they hoped was going to happen with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's almost 50 years old and we're still talking about it. And, it was released, but, before both of us were born. So,
Yeah, and it was really supposed to be a small regional film, as far as I understand. Of like a, there's tons of stories just like the Falcon Monster in other parts of the country. We have the Wood Devil story here in New Hampshire,
yeah.
kinds of stuff. Any one of these subjects could have been in the movie, but for whatever reason, this southern monster made it big, and I think that's really cool. And there's plenty of other stories like that that are kind of waiting to be discovered.
Yeah, I mean that's the good thing as well as as these stories come out, more seems to come following along like a domino effect where people feel more comfortable, I think, recently as well about the Pascagoula case is a prime example of with Calvin Parker there, who's after sort of nearly 45 years of silence has finally come forward and discussed what happened to him. And I think that's a lot to do with the climate changing as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you have shows too, like Finding Bigfoot and a lot of the kind of more reality programming that has come out too, that has raised a lot of interest in the subject of Bigfoot and others as well. And I think we'll continue to see that more now with some of these more independent-minded documentaries, Small Town Monsters, all the other sort of things that are coming out that are more for online streaming and DVD releases that are really grassroots stuff, because people are saying, do a film about my local monster in my town, in my area.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool because somebody eventually will tackle it. If it doesn't happen right away, it'll happen at some point. And yeah, I think that's really awesome and I'm all for it. And hopefully I can be the one to tackle, various creatures. And it's just been a blast so far. I've been extremely lucky to have, been associated with people like Seth and others who really put a lot of time and effort into this stuff.
Yeah, very much so. So, as you were discussing there, you mentioned your YouTube channel, Sasquatch Out of the Shadow. So, how long's that been running, and what made you start that?
Yeah, that. So I've been doing that since around 2016. So it's just kind of been a little side thing. I haven't really taken as much care of it as I probably should, but it was spurred off the idea of doing kind of a feature-length documentary on Sasquatch back in 2016. And I was going to Northern California and I visited Willow Creek, of course, and Bluff Creek and that whole area, very famous spot for people who are interested in this stuff. So that's one of these kind of, I want to say, pilgrimage sites or cryptid tourism place. Perfect. So after visiting there and getting some interviews, I started interviewing people in the New England area who had sightings and encounters with Bigfoot, and I was just hoping to do some kind of documentary, but it was kind of weird to me doing part of it being in California, part of it being in New England. So I just ended up deciding to make shorter, smaller documentaries and kind of unedited interviews or very minimally edited interviews with the witnesses, where I don't take their 20-minute encounter that they just told me about and try and cut it down to a minute or two. I put all the details in there and I just put those out kind of in an episodic format. And then some of them are more kind of documentary style, but others are just straight interviews because I think people really are interested in that kind of stuff. And it gives an idea of what they've experienced as opposed to kind of, like I said, cutting it up a little bit into a small segment, which is often done with a lot of these eyewitness encounters. So it's just been kind of open-ended. And I've been doing that just whenever I get the chance to interview somebody like Jeff Meldrum or other folks that I might run into at a conference, and just put that out there and throw them interesting questions. I mean, have you ever heard of what Jeff Meldrum's favorite cryptid is aside from Bigfoot?
No.
That kind of stuff. Just all sorts of little kind of cool questions like that, I think, are fun. And yeah, that's just, like I said, been sort of a side project, and it's been great because it gives me a reason to kind of drop Bigfoot and then return to it every once in a while. Because like so many, I think in Bigfoot, some of the stuff in the community and kind of the craziness kind of turns me off from the subject every once in a while. So I leave it and then I come back to it when interest comes back. But I feel like it's a love-hate kind of thing.
Yeah, once you're in there, it never really leaves you. I think it's
Yeah,
like you
definitely.
say, you can put it away for a little bit, but it always calls you back in.
Yeah, and I mean the Yeti was the first real monster that I learned about, a cryptid. My dad told me about that story when I was a kid, and that really stuck with me. That one's probably my biggest on my bucket list of going to the Himalayas and some of the monasteries and trying to find the skull cap and all that sort of stuff. That I'm leaving for someday, which I really hope to do.
Yeah, no, very much so. I mean, that always sort of conjures up images for some reason of the 1950s and lots of people just tramping around the Himalayas, with Tom Slick's money, helping everybody try and find as many monsters as they could at the time. It's just a halcyon day for that creature, I think.
Yeah, and I think that was really a romantic kind of era that we think of nowadays, especially in cryptozoology, right? When it was the beginning, the start, when a lot of these people first started getting involved, and it was still sort of exploration, the day of exploration in that time period. So, yeah, there's definitely a call back to that era.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, like we were referring to earlier about the time between Boggy Creek's release, you still mention people like Ivan Sanderson and Eric Shipton. Obviously, Shipton's famous photo of the Yeti footprint next to the pick. You know,
Oh yeah.
that's what's that'll be 70 years old soon.
Amazing. Amazing. And it's just burned into your memory, that picture, right? I mean, I know it is for me at least.
Yeah, very much so. It's one of those pictures I saw as a child, and it has stayed with me my entire life.
Yeah, and I think much to the extent of perhaps the Nessie photo there, even though that's kind of been debunked in a lot of ways, the Mansi photo, the Patty, that one frame, all these sorts of images I think are kind of burned in our minds. If we've been looking at this since we were young, so that's cool though.
Oh, very much so. So, as you mentioned there, Nessie. One of your first films and documentaries you made was about Loch Ness. What made you want to come to Scotland to visit the area?
Yeah, that was really my first kind of documentary on the cryptid subject, or any cryptid really. And it was spurred on, of course, by wanting to visit Loch Ness. I mean, that's one of these sites that, probably watched the most documentaries on Nessie, even though Bigfoot was more popular, sort of, and generally is more popular. But Nessie and Bigfoot, I say, are the top two cryptids. I went on a family trip to Scotland, and of course, I said, we have to go to Loch Ness. We have to go to Loch Ness. So we did end up doing that. And just kind of, I got the idea, well, I have a camera, I might as well just start talking to people and get some cool footage and just put a little something together. And that's really where it came from. It was nothing special in my mind, just kind of a short little thing. And lo and behold, people liked it. And that's kind of what got me more into the Bigfoot documentaries right after that. But yeah, it was fun to explore that and tackle that because it's something that I've, like I said, watched so much about and read so much about over the years. And it's always fun when you get to do your own take on a subject that you consider yourself really familiar with, to learn different things about it. And I kind of came out of the whole Loch Ness thing a little less enthusiastic about it than perhaps before, which is really interesting. A lot of people say, oh, did it cement your belief in it? And I kind of, even visiting there, I was a little bit more, I'd say, kind of skeptical. At the end, I don't know. It seems like there was something there at some point, but the waters became so muddied with all the investigations and all the controversies and everything that I don't know where I stand at this point. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be fair, I understand exactly how you feel because I went to Loch Ness about 15 years ago, and when I came back, I was more. No, I don't think so. than I ever thought possible because I'm like you say, it's one of those creatures you. If you're into this subject, you know all about it. You know all about the surgeon's photo and who's done what, and people like Adrian Shine, who've spent the best part of 50 years looking for it. And we did the same. We were on a holiday in Scotland, and we spent about I think we were there 3 days. It was stunning. It was beautiful as well. The weather was fantastic. But I came back after that, and I wouldn't say jaded was the right word, but it certainly made me question it a lot more.
Yeah, that's kind of how I came out from it as well. Very similar, which is kind of funny because with Champ, I came out sort of in the other direction. I don't know. Champ was interesting because that's something, having grown up in New England, Lake Champlain is kind of considered the west coast of New England, so to speak. It's a huge lake. I didn't know too much about it. I'd only passed through the area every once in a while, and I knew of Champ from seeing the documentaries, but for some reason, I was not as interested in it as I was Nessie, which is so strange considering the distance, 3 hours to across the Atlantic Ocean. But when I went into CHAMP doing the series for Small Town Monsters, I didn't know a lot about it. And I immediately kind of, maybe I should have known a little bit more about it, but I kind of prefer the way I did it, where I didn't know too much about it. I knew the rough history, but once you dive into it, I went in, you know, nose first, so to speak. And it was like an information overload. And now it's probably the favorite thing I've ever investigated. And I'm still hopelessly obsessed with it. And every chance I get, I'm over there at Lake Champlain. And I know deep down that the series, you know, which I tried to make as in-depth as I possibly could, that will not be my last time examining CHAMP in sort of either film or a literary kind of sense, because I think there's so much to it, and it is the most fascinating thing I've investigated. I'm going to be honest, and I'm biased in saying that CHAMP is probably my favorite cryptid too. I love them all, but CHAMP is definitely the top.
Yeah, I must admit, in the years that I've learned about that particular case and Ogopogo's the other one, I think in Canada. I think if you're going to find something strange in some kind of body of water, I think Champlain or Ogopogo are probably my two top choices for where something might turn up.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, I'm not as familiar with Ogopogo. Of course, I'm really interested in that and kind of the West Coast monsters in that area, British Columbia. They have a lot of Bigfoot stuff. But with CHAMP, it's like, man, it just wants to go down the rabbit hole, as you said. I mean, just a few weeks ago, I visited Whitehall, New York, first time, which is, of course, is known for Bigfoot, and it's kind of considered the Bigfoot capital of the East Coast. And what a lot of people don't know is that some of the CHAMP sightings of the 1870s took place right outside of Whitehall. That's where the lake starts. And in town nowadays, you have Bigfoot statues and Sasquatch Saloon and souvenir shops, and then you have CHAMP's restaurant and CHAMP statues, and it's like Bigfoot and CHAMP interacting in the same area, and I think that's interesting. And like I said, Whitehall starts, or the lake starts in Whitehall and extends all the way up into Canada. So you have 120-something miles of shoreline on bordering two different states and partly in Canada of just CHAMP lore and legend and sightings, and the story goes on and on. It's almost unfathomable how large of a mystery it is, given the proportions of the area that it's in and how little there are people investigating. And that's something I talked about in the series, was unlike with Bigfoot or UFOs or these other subjects, CHAMP has, you can count all the people investigating it probably on one hand at this point. It's very, you know, it's not a very popular, so to say, subject to investigate. So, and there's so much there, and it's just extreme task for a couple of people to cover.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and to put it in perspective, Lake Champlain is as wide at one point as Loch Ness is as long. So I think that just shows you the size of Lake Champlain alone is mind-boggling, especially for somebody in the UK. Because obviously Loch Ness is our biggest body of water in the UK, but when you compare it to somewhere, you know, like Lake Champlain, which is even, you know, dwarfed by many of the Great Lakes themselves, it's enormous.
It is. And once you're on the lake, you get that feeling. Even in the southern sections where it's a little bit narrower, you just see, you look in the distance and you just see this water that just goes on. You don't see mountains in the background or anything. At one point, you go up to Burlington and some of the other areas where it's the widest, and it's huge. It looks like a great lake. I mean, it feels like it, but obviously, like you said, it is dwarfed by a lot of the Great Lakes, which are basically like inland seas. And speaking of inland sea, I mean, Lake Champlain was part of the sea, and that's something I talked about in the series pretty extensively, because I didn't know much about that history and the geology of the area, and the fact that just 10, 12,000 years ago, it was connected to the ocean, and you had whales and all sorts of aquatic animals that lived in what is now Lake Champlain that became landlocked. So I think the precedence for something perhaps adapting from the ocean is there. Whether or not it's realistic or not, I don't know. But people are seeing something very unusual in the lake, and there's a lot of competing theories. And I think it's really one of the most interesting cases of lake monsters, just because you have so many of the right ingredients there. And it's so kind of it's underplayed compared to Loch Ness or perhaps some of the other lake monsters.
Yeah, I mean, it suffers from that, like, you know, as we always refer to Nessie, so is the, probably the most famous lake monster in the world. Anywhere else, it's always, you know, I've seen it, it might not happen so much in the States, but over here, it's Lake Champlain's always described as America's Loch Ness, and Ogopogo is Canada's Nessie. And it's like, well, hang on, I'm sure it's that country's preferred monster themselves.
Right, right. I'm guilty of that too. I mean, I did with the intro of my series, I did call it Exploring America's Loch Ness. But I think because people know it as that, people know Loch Ness, and generally speaking, people who are outside of the cryptid or kind of the exploring the unknown, I'm talking about the general populace, they know of Loch Ness and they know of Bigfoot. So if you say something is America's Loch Ness, they say, oh, okay, they associate that with a monster. So it's almost like an easier way to convey to somebody that there's something going on that perhaps has no idea what lake monsters are, and you kind of broaden your audience in that sense. But yeah, it is a little bit of a funny kind of identity. And I guess a lot of people joke about, you know, Nessie and Champlain kind of cousins. And to be fair, the lakes were both formed in very similar ways at one point, connected to the ocean, and glaciers receding and a lot of that sort of stuff. And it created a very unique window in time where it was locked. It was connected to the ocean and became landlocked. So yeah.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's perplexing, as you refer to, that it's probably not got as in-depth a search or a continual study to it that perhaps we have seen in regards to, like, you know, we've referred to Bigfoot especially. It's worthy of further exploration across the board for me.
Right. And what's crazy about it is, I mean, Loch Ness has essentially been investigated in some capacity or other since the 1930s, since, you know, kind of the original sightings and the photograph, of course, and all in that time period. But, and there's always been somebody at some point investigating. Lake Champlain has really only been investigated since probably the 1960s. That's really when some of the first groups were started, with Joseph Zarzynski and Philip Rhines and some of the other folks investigating it. And that's really when the media kind of caught on to it in modern times. But in the 1870s, Champ was known across the U.S. because of the sightings that were taking place and the extraordinary nature in which the newspapers reported and probably exaggerated a lot of what was going on, to the point where P.T. Barnum, the noted showman, put a very hefty bounty on Champ's head in the 1870s. And these were a lot of those sightings that I mentioned that took place sort of near Whitehall in the southern part of the lake. And that's really when Lake Champlain started being kind of settled, and to a greater extent, they were building railroads, and that's where some of these stories kind of emerged. So after that, Champ kind of had a heyday, and then it fell out into the 20th century, and there would be sightings here and there, and a New York Times article, but it really wasn't that common. So for me, when I was interviewing eyewitnesses, I had a really wide range of ages and people that I interviewed. One of the people who had the earliest sightings that I interviewed was a guy who saw it in the 1950s. You probably remember him from episode 2. And he talked about how they were fishing and they saw this thing that looked like a dinosaur head come out of the water in the 1950s. And they all agreed, you know, six or seven of them, to not tell anyone because they're going to think you're crazy. And they said it wasn't until 20 years later, when Champ started being covered in the news and was popular, that they were kind of comfortable with talking about their story, even to their loved ones. So that, I thought that was very interesting. And then Champ had that sort of second heyday from the 70s into the 90s, I would say, when it was very popular. You had a lot of these documentaries covering it. And then it kind of fell out of fashion again. And I think it's been sort of kind of chugging along slowly since then. And I think there's been a little bit of resurgence with the series and perhaps newer researchers that have come on the scene in the past 10 years, like Katie Elizabeth and Scott Martis and a lot of the other people as well.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. No, it's fascinating. It really is. So being based in New England on that side, you've started to look into these mysterious reports of lions turning up that's – it isn't so unusual for the States. However, they're not supposed to be there at all. They're extinct in that area. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's what's the weird part. So with cryptozoology, you know, most people think of the subject being associated with Bigfoot and lake monsters, chupacabra, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, if you look into it, it's actually involving out of place animals, creatures that are possibly still alive, having survived extinction, like the thylacine, coelacanth, of course, all these other species. So the mountain lion, or the eastern mountain lion, fits directly right into that, because this is a case of an animal that was once indigenous to this region. New England was, you know, famous for having bears and mountain lions and deer and lots of large critters. And a lot of these areas were clear cut in the 19th century and into that time period. And sadly, a lot of the mountain lions were hunted to extinction. Basically, you have a lot of these states where the last mountain lion that was killed at the time, they have it sort of documented, and now they have them stuffed and put in the museums, state history, what have you. Hmm. But since they really went extinct, there have been sightings from the 1930s on, and more. And now we're getting more sightings than ever. And that was something I'd heard for years, even before getting into kind of investigating cryptozoology and the documentaries on my own. I would hear stories from people just growing up saying, oh, yeah, we know there's mountain lions on our property, or we've seen them, this kind of thing, even though they're technically extinct and their range really is supposed to be from the Rocky Mountains and then westward into Canada and California, Pacific Northwest. That's really their accepted range nowadays, where they have populations of established mountain lions or cougars, pumas, catamounts, panthers. There's virtually a different name in wherever the country, which is kind of funny. Like when I was in Arkansas now, they call them panthers. And I thought they were meaning like a black panther, but they were talking about mountain lions. But then, of course, there are the sightings of the black panthers as well, which throws a whole kind of wrench into the whole equation. But yeah, so it's been extremely fascinating. And that kind of, like I said, hearing those sightings back in the day really spurred on my interest. And I said, well, I should look into this, because it's going on virtually all around me. And there's got to be more to it. And once you go down the rabbit hole, you know the rest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that interests me, because obviously we've got a similar spate of them, usually in the southeast corner of the UK, of cats that are not supposed to be in this country at all, and people constantly, you know, that belittle them and say, oh, it's just a misidentified house cat. But that's not the kind of mistake you could make in the States, because you know you're talking about fairly large animals.
Yeah, exactly. And so for New England, you had a lot of species that have returned ever since the clear cuts, and now the New England states like Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire are actually some of the highest forested states in the country. So Maine, I think, is 95% forested now. Wow. And a lot of that land is just barren land. New Hampshire is number two, around 93-92%, and Vermont is similar. And we have a lot of mountains, a lot of rugged terrain. So it's the perfect environment for a lot of these animals to have returned. We have almost 30,000 black bear now in New England. We have moose, which are the largest animal basically in this entire area. Mm. Huge, massive creatures. There's been some reports of gray wolves as well, which were like the mountain lion, hunted to extinction or extirpated. That's kind of the scientific term is, they're not an extinct species. They're just extirpated from an area.
Yeah.
This case would be New England. But the sightings have continued. I mean, and people have seen breeding pairs. They've seen all sorts of mountain lions. You know, 80-90% of the sightings are of that brown, tawny kind of color, tan, which is what you'd expect. But we do have bobcats in New England, and to some extent in the northern parts, there is the lynx, the Canada lynx. Mm. But they're much smaller animals, and they have a very small tail. And there have been misidentifications, and I've talked to folks with some of the fish and wildlife departments here who say they'll get a picture of what somebody says is a mountain lion and it turns out to be a bobcat. But what I look for when I hear like an eyewitness talking about they saw a mountain lion is usually the first thing they mention is the tail.
Yeah.
The long tail, and either with, you know, kind of a black spot at the end, or just a long flowing tail, which is like half the length of the body. And there's nothing else that has that characteristic that lives out in the woods, unless there is an escaped panther or something like that. So it's very clean cut in that aspect. And that's really where it gets interesting, because you have so many of the competing theories about what is going on. And you have documented cases and documented evidence, which I can get into a little bit more. But there's various camps of kind of thinking, and having interviewed lots of people involved in it, it's been interesting to see where that has kind of led me.
Yeah, very. I mean, at the end of the day, regardless of scientific evidence or whatever, you're talking about migratory species, and as you refer to the wolf, there's a very recent example the other week. They've finally been confirmed as moving back to the Netherlands, where they haven't been for 150 years.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
And people for about 10 years have been seeing wolves running about, and they said, oh no, it's just people, you know, just people. Wolves just popping over the border from Germany and just checking things out. But now they've realized that they've got an established colony there and they're growing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think our borders don't really mean anything to wildlife. Yeah. I mean, these things can move around. And that's what's been interesting in the New England case. Where, I mean, this is something I heard about. I went to college in Connecticut, the state of Connecticut, in a southern New England. It's a little bit of a smaller state, much more urbanized, I'd say, although there are still a lot of forest land. But in 2011, there was a mountain lion that was killed in a very suburban part of the state, right by the coast, in a place called Milford, Connecticut. And this is probably only an hour's drive from New York City, to give you some perspective. Yeah. It was on a busy kind of expressway, kind of a parkway. And the DNA analysis showed that it belonged to a population of mountain lions that lived in the Black Hills in the Dakotas, in South Dakota, I believe. So this creature traveled that entire distance, and it was kind of a young male. So the idea is perhaps you have younger males traveling from known populations that are looking for a mate once they kind of get kicked out of their family group or they mature. They're looking for a mate, and they just kind of wander around. And a lot of people think, you know, there could be, let's say, for example, a dozen males wandering around New England at one given time, and that could explain a lot of the sightings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've also got that aspect to their lifestyle that, you know, the young males are often thrown out to go and fend for themselves, so have to travel fair distances to get themselves their own established territory, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the lengths they'll go to if they get desperate enough. That's really when some of these kind of incidents happen, where they get close to towns and tragically get killed by a car. But you have one documented case for all of New England in this Connecticut case, but you have hundreds and probably thousands of sightings that have taken place since the 1930s and even before that. And I've looked at, you know, evidence of people in the 1930s claiming they saw a mountain lion, they tried to kill it and shoot it, even though it would have already been extinct for almost 50 years in the region at the time. But like I said, with the competing theories, you then have the theory that there are some breeding pairs and a breeding population and some, maybe a few individuals in each state that would produce enough offspring to kind of have a smaller impact on the environment. That's one of the theories I've heard. But I think most people believe that the lone male theory is kind of the most credible at this point. And the fact that maybe it's only a matter of time until there's a female in the equation, and that's really when something else may occur. You know, you may have a population. It's tough to say, but you have these sightings across the rest of the East Coast, all the way down south. I mean, the only established kind of mountain lion or cougar population outside of those western areas is in Florida. You have the Florida Panthers down in the Everglades, and then they have sightings in Louisiana and all these other places coming from the western population or from Florida, who knows? So all these states across the eastern seaboard have these sightings. New England is just the kind of the furthest up that you go. And obviously into Canada, we've got Quebec right above us and Ontario above New York State. And there's just millions of acres of wilderness and these dense forests. And I think the environment is a lot different than out in the west and in the Rockies. You have a lot of these kind of these plains and more desert-like areas, and then in the higher elevations is where you'll have patches of forest. So they say the average mountain lion has a range of like 100 miles.
Yes.
It'll exist within that area, but that's because it's moving from kind of forest to forest, whereas in New England, you can literally be outside of a town and be in a complete ecosystem with, we have an abundance of deer because there really isn't many predators that are getting them. We have big deer problem in a lot of the states. So there's ample food sources, ample water sources, ample cover. I mean, like you could get from one New England state to the next, just patches of woods, and, you know, cats are very stealthy. So I think that helps them in that aspect. And I think, you know, it really comes down to the fact there probably is a mountain lion as we speak somewhere in New England walking around or interacting with this environment. The question is just what extent are they here?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I think it's one of those things when you ask your average person about what they imagine the US to look like, a lot of people wouldn't expect New England to be anywhere near that kind of varied ecosystem. The perception is always it's quite industrial.
Yeah, that's funny. People always imagine that, and that really kind of throws me off. You know, living in a state like New Hampshire, we have so many mountains, and we have some of the tallest mountains in the Northeast here. I mean, Mount Washington, which has some of the highest wind speeds recorded in history, you know, on planet Earth. And it's a very rugged environment. People get lost up in the mountains and die almost every other week. It's really kind of tragic. And for those of us in the hiking community, you know, I hear about this stuff all the time. People underestimate the extent, you know, because, you know, we have Boston, we have New York City, 4 hours down, Connecticut. A lot of these states are a little bit more industrialized, but the northern parts of New England are completely, you know, probably more wild than they even were 300 years ago when they were being clear cut and kind of tamed, so to speak. And you have all these animals returning, and people don't understand that there are many Bigfoot sightings too. There are Bigfoot in every single New England state, and there are older stories that exist, you know, stories like wild men sightings and these kind of terms that were used by the newspapers before we had the modern conception of Sasquatch or Bigfoot or the abominable snowman. We're talking pre-20th century sort of stuff. And then, of course, Champ, sea monsters. There's a lot of different cryptids in New England. And just given how much, you know, space there is kind of wilderness-wise.
Yeah, they've certainly got plenty of room to move, I think.
Yeah, it's
probably what makes it so enticing, I would suspect.
Yeah, and it's very, I think, you know, like I said, people know about the Dover Demon or they'll know about Champ. Those are probably the two top New England sort of creatures that are known. But then you have something like the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts, which everyone knows about. It's kind of this weird area where you have everything under the paranormal umbrella: Bigfoot, UFOs, ghosts, Native American curses. There's a very kind of enticing history. We have Salem, Massachusetts, of course, is a big one for people more into the witchcraft and that sort of stuff. International Cryptozoology Museum is in Maine. We have that with Lauren Coleman.
Yep.
And a lot of his work was, his early days was based here in New England. I mean, he coined the term Bridgewater Triangle and Dover Demon, a lot of these terms that now exist. But yeah, there's definitely a lot to examine, which is really nice. I mean, there's so many of these mysteries across the country and across the world. But people, I think, in New England oftentimes that are not so familiar with this really think, oh, Bigfoot's in California, got Loch Ness in Scotland, whatever, skunk apes in Florida. There's nothing around here. It's like the total opposite. I mean, puckwudgies, I mean, that even made it into Harry Potter.
And yeah.
That's a Wampanoag story from New England. Of these little demon-like spirits that kind of will entice you to come into the woods. And some believe they still exist, or there's some kind of a spiritual manifestation. I don't know. It's a creepy story.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, but,
yeah. Cause, I think I've seen that there's a Bridgewater documentary on Amazon.
Yeah.
And there's a chap in that who's out walking his dog, and he describes an encounter with a pugwudgie. I'm sure he basically says it tries to lure him into the woods.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know the director of that. Yeah, it's the great piece. And actually, the guy who did the narration is a friend of mine who's involved in cryptozoology. He'll be narrating my Lions of the East documentary. But yeah, the Puckwudgie story, I mean, it's really just, like you said, kind of in that documentary, it's shown as it's trying to kind of get him to go into places. And there's other footage to show of apparently someone being kind of possessed.
Mm.
But it's associated with this Freetown State Forest in Massachusetts, which is kind of notable for satanic cult activity.
Yeah.
A lot of strange stuff. And it was also a place where the mafia would take people to execute them and dump their bodies, because it was perfectly positioned that it's kind of in between Providence, Rhode Island, and Boston, Massachusetts, where you had a lot of the Irish and the Italian mafia back in the day. You've probably seen like The Departed and some of those films. So that was an area where they would dump bodies. And just north of there in the Triangle area is the Hockomock Swamp, which is kind of considered the place where spirits dwell. Yeah. That's how the natives referred to it. And, you know, that's where you have a lot of the Bigfoot and the Thunderbird sightings, even giant snakes, supposedly some kind of octopus-like creature in the water.
Yeah.
I mean, name it, like the glowing orbs in the woods over the water, all kinds of stuff. And it's just really weird, anomalous area. But there are other spots like it in New England, too, that are much less publicized that I think are equally as interesting. But when you have a place like the Bridgewater Triangle that takes on a kind of life of its own, maybe it becomes so famous that I think people go in there with the intent of having an experience, and they probably come out with something that they wanted to happen, or kind of the power of suggestion sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's often the danger you've got as well when you're dealing with this kind of field and certain areas or certain creatures become notorious. You go in there with an expectation of what's going to happen. Now, yeah, whether that actually happens, I think for some people it doesn't particularly matter, or they simply misinterpret something that under normal circumstances wouldn't be particularly odd.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, an example I like to point to is, it's sort of funny, but let's say you have on any given night in the woods out there in the Freetown State Forest or the Hockomock Swamp, you have a ghost hunting team that goes out there to do EPP stuff. Mm. And then you have a bunch of Bigfooters, and the Bigfooters start doing calls and they start doing wood knocks. And the ghost people maybe are saying, oh, we had a Bigfoot experience. And then they put that in their database, and you see how that can kind of happen. I think that happens, you know.
Yeah.
You have to be wary of that sort of thing. But like I said, there are other anomalous areas that I've looked into that I think are equally as interesting, but are way less well known. There's one in Pennsylvania. Mm. I don't want to say too much about it, but I'm going back there end of May. I've been there once before with some authors and researcher friends of mine in New England that kind of have been specializing in this sort of strange case. There's another one in New Hampshire, which is one of my favorites, called the Ossipee Triangle. And it happens in an area that's really weird. It's like a perfect circular mountain range. If you look at it on like a map, it's very weird. It's a place where actually Aleister Crowley went up there to worship on a mountain. Supposedly there was a sacrificial table up there while he was in the U.S. He was involved in some kind of stuff there, which very interesting guy. There's been UFO encounters in that area. One of my favorite Bigfoot sightings has happened in that area, where in the 1970s a guy saw basically a Bigfoot-like creature inside of a stone structure with like a thatched roof made out of hemlock branches. I mean, this is probably one of the only Bigfoot sightings that I'm aware of that involves a structure. I know that's a big thing in the community, is, you know, people talk about stick structures, and I've seen all sorts of stuff out in the woods that I it's very ambiguous. It's hard for me to say either way, but this case involved that. And this guy, I interviewed him at length for about an hour regarding this case. And, you know, he said, I still am not sure what it was, but it let out this kind of scream. I guess what happened was, to sum it up in short, they were doing some mineral searching kind of in the area, rock collecting in a very remote part of this mountain range in the Ossipee Mountains. And they came across this strange structure, and the dog they had started growling when they saw this sort of shaggy, hairy looking creature sitting inside. And the dog started growling, and this thing let out a scream that kind of scared all of them away. It was this gentleman, his girlfriend, and the dog, and they were terrified, and they ended up just running away. And of course, halfway down the mountain, they realized they had a camera with them. But in that moment, you know, and it took it took him a year to get back there. He was just freaked out. He went back up there, and there was not a trace of this structure or anything in the area where he had seen it. So that happened in this Ossipee Triangle. And then also recently a mountain lion case of a biologist I interviewed, he found mountain lion DNA that was confirmed by a lab there in the Ossipee Range. He sent it out to a lab in Wyoming, and the state of New Hampshire kind of downplayed his findings and even had the lab issue a bit of a retraction on that finding. So it's almost like a conspiracy kind of thing. I don't want to, get myself too much trouble by talking about that. That's really what it kind of seems like. And that happened in this sort of Ossipee area, which I think is kind of a freaky spot. It's a small area, but there seems to be a lot going on. And, you know, it's nowhere near as known as the Bridgewater Triangle.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, like you were referring to there about the DNA testing, I think that also leads into, you know, without wishing to sound too conspiratorial, it does often seem that basic evidence has to, essentially in this case, would be to jump up and bite someone for them to accept that there is something going on there. So is it a case of, do you think that they just want to ignore it until it gets past that point, or they're just suppressing it because they know they're already back?
Yeah, that's the question, man. That's the tricky one. And without getting too political, I mean, I honestly think it probably comes down more to money than anything else. As we know, with government agencies, they're always cash strapped, despite taking as much as they can in taxes from us and whatever the case may be. But, you know, I think dealing with a mountain lion is much different than dealing with a bear or even coyotes or other indigenous animals. You know, it's an apex predator. It behaves differently than a bear. So you're just going to have to allocate different money towards that. So I think that's primarily one of the issues why they kind of are downplaying some of the evidence, because there have been confirmed cases. I mean, in the case of the Connecticut cat, you know, it was undeniable because you had people pulling over and taking pictures of it. You couldn't really, I don't want to say cover it up or kind of put it to the side, but in that case, you couldn't. So how many cases are there that we don't know about, are some of the ones that I've been finding out about that are have been going on for years that nobody knows about, that are kind of thrown to the side? And I think it's going to take probably someone getting attacked for their real serious look at it. That happened in Massachusetts on Cape Cod with great white sharks, which turned in large numbers. And I've talked about this before, too. You know, we had a fatal attack on Cape Cod just this past September, and I went down to that beach less than a week after the attack, and I spoke to a guy who saw it happen, and, you know, he was talking about how the seal population had exploded since the 70s. There was a Mammal Protection Act, and there's 70,000 seals, and the great whites returned, and now they're starting to do shark tours, and they're saying Cape Cod is going to be one of the major shark destinations, like South Africa, Australia, some of the other places you normally think of. And it took that sort of attack for there to be like a serious look at what could be done. And that was the second attack in the same year. That one just happened to be fatal. We'll see what's going to happen this summer with, you know, because that's a big tourist spot. But that's, I don't know. It seems like there's no like really preventative measures that get taken. It's just the aftermath. That's kind of what they try to manage. And with the mountain lions, I mean, I don't think that the numbers, if they are here, are very large. And if there are breeding pairs or if it's just lone males, I don't think it's to the point where it would need to be necessarily dangerous. I mean, you have states out west, they kind of coexist with mountain lions. You'll hear of an attack every once in a while. But I don't think it's, you know, it's not like you're living with some sort of a monster from a science fiction movie that's just eating your children. I mean, you have to learn to coexist with these things, because we live with bears around here. I mean, we have bears that will come into your street, and you'll get an email from kind of a neighbor saying, watch out for the bear, or it's getting into your trash. You just kind of got to learn to live with it. And that's something I think that it would help to educate the public regarding that. And that's something I hope that my documentary can kind of allow people to maybe educate themselves a little bit more about it, and just be careful, be cautious. You shouldn't be inhibited from going out in the woods by being scared of whatever may be out there. Just learn to kind of coexist.
Yeah, very much. I mean, to be fair, I think I've seen numerous videos over the years where basically someone's filming out their patio door and there's a massive mountain lion pouring at it because there's a cat inside. I mean, there's countless videos like that. I think I saw one pop up the other day where they got two just running about in the back garden.
Yeah. That happens with bears in New England. I have people who send me videos like that, very similar stuff. I think I saw a mountain lion video recently, though, from Florida, where it was like a security camera on someone's driveway, and the mountain lion just scooped up their house cat and just took it off. And yeah. I mean, it was kind of gruesome. You could hear the crunching when with the pressure down on its neck. It was kind of a bit of, you know, not pleasant to see, especially if you're a fan of house cats, but, you know, that's the nature of the beast, so to speak.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that's the other thing as well, is that, you know, at the end of the day, as you refer to them, these are apex predators, and unfortunately, in populated areas, they will have a large supply of domestic pets.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in an area like Connecticut, like I said, the area where that particular mountain lion was killed in 2011 was, it's very populated. I mean, you've got shopping and malls all over the place. So it's a very populated area, a lot of roads, very urban. The patches of woods are very small, but this creature was still able to kind of move its way around, supposedly either coming down from New York State or from Massachusetts and moving into Connecticut. And I met a police officer who saw that particular mountain lion 3 days before it was killed, only, you know, 5-6 miles from the spot where it was killed. And as a police officer, we give them sort of more credibility because they're supposed to be trained observers and kind of stewards of the law, if you will. So he had seen what he described as a mountain lion, the long tail, everything. He said, of course, people didn't really believe me. But then 3 days later, there was one that was killed, and it had to be that one. I mean, that was the kind of the assumption they made. So he's probably the only person in all of New England who's had their mountain lion sighting confirmed, you know, on a wide scale. So pretty interesting. But in that case, like I said, in Connecticut, you know, the food sources probably wouldn't have been as readily available as they would be in Vermont or upstate New Hampshire, where you have, you know, so many deer that they have to wrap their apple trees with a fence so the deer can't get to it, or their orchards, you know, that kind of happens on the regular. But down in an area like Connecticut, house cats, maybe small dogs, those are all on the menu, basically. And that's the risk that happens with when you're living, kind of coexisting with these animals.
Yeah, very much so. So obviously doing the film, have you been sort of to any sort of key areas for sightings? Have you had anything tangible come across your camera so far?
Yeah, I mean, the tricky part with that is, you know, people often ask any kind of cryptid or any creature, is there a hotspot? Is there an area? With New England, it's really tricky because, like I said, there's so much forest and so much land. You could virtually go anywhere and have a bear or another animal or Bigfoot sightings. You know, the clusters don't really happen as much as you'd expect. So with the mountain lions, it's really tricky. Like, the area in which most of the sightings happen is like a 200 square mile radius from, you know, in between the Connecticut Valley and New Hampshire and Vermont. It's very tough to pin that down. But the tangible sort of stuff is that, like I said, the people I've interviewed who have had, you know, DNA evidence that's been confirmed. And, you know, I have people that I'm waiting to interview as well who have had, one lady had her horse actually attacked by what turned out to be a mountain lion. And the same kind of thing, this time it was in Massachusetts as opposed to the biologist in New Hampshire. You know, she had her horse attacked by something. The state kind of said that, oh, it was her negligence that resulted in the animal getting injured, and that really aggravated her. You know, horse people are very passionate about their beloved horses. So she investigated her whole property, and she found blood and hair samples and sent that off to a lab, and it came back as surprisingly mountain lion. So that there's a lot of stories, I think, like that, that are not even known. You know, I've found out about these sort of cases either through people contacting me directly or kind of back channel sort of stuff, where it's, you know, did you know about this story? Because it hasn't been as widely publicized. And I think that's for a reason, like I said, with sort of the downplaying, because you don't want to get a panic on your hands either. Because people, if they hear that there's maybe a mystery cat running around the woods, they might arm up and go and shoot everything that moves in the woods. That's a risk as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing as well that would be concerned is that, you know, it takes some guts to try and take down a horse.
Yeah, I mean, but if you think about it, we've all seen the documentaries on Animal Planet and Discovery Channel of how lions will attack larger animals like wildebeest and these other things. Mountain lions will do the same thing to a larger animal. They'll jump on their back, and I guess they try and then go for the neck and the jugular sort of thing. And that, I don't know the full story of what happened in this case, but, you know, this mountain lion got injured in the process, so there was obviously some kind of struggle. And like you said, it's pretty bold to attack something that's way bigger than you that could probably trample you to death.
Yeah.
So there was a struggle that ensued, and that's kind of what resulted in the mountain lion leaving a blood sample, which was corroborated by hair sample as well, and the horse being injured, of course, too. And the horse kind of destroyed a part of a fence and cut itself on that as well. So it's very interesting in that sense. You know, you have, when you're able to corroborate the DNA, especially, that's something that with a lot of these subjects is so sought after. And when you have it there, it's a big find.
Absolutely. And I think that also, that whole situation there for me, would lead me to suspect it would be something like a juvenile male, because they're probably not as savvy and as clever, so he'd probably come across a horse and think, oh, I fancy my chances here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like a recklessness.
Yeah.
They're very bold. I mean, they're not really savvy, street savvy. They don't know how things work, you know, the risk versus the reward. And I think that's what a lot of people perhaps describe with, say, Bigfoot and Sasquatch sightings. It's the same kind of thing where there's maybe riskier behavior. It's kind of a juvenile that's usually described, at least in some of the stuff that I've seen, whereas perhaps an older, wiser creature might be more hip to these kind of things and learn how to kind of be more tactical about it. But also the desperation factor. So with the mountain lion, you know, if there isn't a food source that's as available, maybe it's just so desperate that it goes for something as easy as an animal that's in an enclosed area, as opposed to expending all your energy chasing a deer for 10 miles before killing it, right?
Yeah, very much. Well, yeah, that's also an excellent argument. Maybe it's because of the fact it's that far out of its range, it was just starving.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe it just wasn't used to the environment and it was moving through various different areas. And you can imagine coming through the Midwest, where a lot of the areas aren't as heavily forested. You kind of have patches. Once you get to an area where there's a lot more environment, maybe that's a little overwhelming, and its instincts, it doesn't really know what to do. I mean, I don't know. How do you put yourselves in the shoes of a mountain lion or a big panther, right? That's it. But the equation that's always the weirdest is the whole Black Panther angle. And that's something that, you know, I just came across a book recently, even stories from New Hampshire in the 1920s and 30s, where people were saying they were seeing black panthers, you know, mountain lions that were essentially just black colored, and that's something that doesn't happen supposedly naturally. There's no melanistic mountain lions that have been documented, but these sightings are across the country in all these sorts of places, and that's something I think that overlaps with the British alien big cats, and even in Australia, some of these other areas. It makes you wonder what's going on.
It is peculiar. I was about to say exactly the same thing there, Alexander. It's peculiar that you've got people seeing something which there is no genetic record. It occasionally happens, and it's a freak.
Right. But, yeah, I mean, how many escaped pets or escaped exotic animals can there be? I mean,
yes.
There's really only, especially if we're talking in the 1940s and earlier, when that wasn't even that common to have an escaped or an exotic pet of that nature, as like a black leopard or something from you know, tropical sort of area, and how these animals would be able to survive in totally different environments. So that opens up a whole nother can of worms, so to speak. And I'm going to touch a little bit upon that in the documentary, but for the most part, it's focused on the kind of run of the mill, regular sort of mountain lion that you'd expect, because that's like 80% of the sightings, you know, right? Like a very small percentage are the more anomalous ones, and the ones that are kind of, you know, not really fitting in that mold of what you'd expect, really.
Yeah, very much. I think that's the added extra intrigue to these cases, I think. Like you say, it's mysterious enough that people are claiming to see mountain lions and nobody will admit that they're there. But the fact that on top of this, you've got a select niche of people who are seeing something that shouldn't be there, seems even more mysterious than a normal cat, because they're always seem to be described as, I don't know, there's always something different about the description, if you know what I mean, when they see these mystery the black cats. And it's peculiar because they are, what, you know, Australia has no history of these animals at all. They're not ever there. So how they've now got the same thing going on there is even more peculiar.
It is. I mean, Australia, of course, a lot of the known animal life there evolved very differently. That's why you have sort of the marsupials and the kangaroos and all these other animals that aren't as typical as other ones. So the fact that that's going on there, too, is very interesting. And then, of course, in the UK, I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked into it enough, but to me, it's a very strange kind of phenomenon. And, you know, the conspiracies, they go on, and the alien big cat, kind of the weird connection there, or a lot of states here in the U.S., people saying that, you know, when I was down in Arkansas, people were saying, oh, yeah, they bring in the mountain lions and they just release them to kill all the hogs, because down there they have a big wild boar problem.
Yeah.
Nasty animals. I mean, we were walking around in Falk when we were doing night investigations, we're finding these big, huge areas of dug up dirt.
Yeah.
And I, you know, we were with some folks from Louisiana and asked them, is this what a hog did? It looks like, you know, a dinosaur came through and ripped through the area.
Yeah.
And they're like, that's what a hog does. Cause obviously I'm not used to seeing that. We don't have that around here. So it's a big problem. And they're nasty. And people down there straight faced would tell me, in between talking about the Falk monster, they'd say, oh yeah, we got panthers here. The state brought them in. They're here to contain the hog population. I mean, it's totally nonchalantly. I'm like, wow. And I've heard the same thing up this way too. And it's just one of these stories that people kind of spin around. And like I said earlier, there's like a distrust with the authorities, and they're like, oh, they're denying the sighting. Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all. That's I've gotten that more than one occasion. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, well, that's the other, you know, I'm fully aware of the damage that hogs can do. We've got a population that were released by accident in England, and they are running amok in the Forest of Dean, which is on the south coast of the UK. And that's getting to a point where someone's going to have a nasty run-in with a big hog.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, it's, you got to be careful. That's what they told us the most down south, too, is that's probably the biggest thing you have to worry about, is that and cottonmouth snakes, which are really venomous. These alligators, you know, they're not even that aggressive unless you step on one or get in a nest or something. But hogs, I mean, you don't run into one of those. And we were down there, and Lyle had been filming with a group of people that we ended up hanging out with too, and they found a big hog skull, very clean, and they put it out there in the Monster Mart in Falk, and I had a chance to look at that thing, and this thing's tusks. I mean, the teeth were just, oh man, I can't imagine if that thing was charging at you and got you, clipped you with one of those tusks. That would be an awful experience.
Yeah, very much. Well, I Monster Quest famously did an episode on Hogzilla.
Yeah, I remember.
That was terrifying. It was enormous.
I mean, it's amazing. And it kind of makes you feel good about eating bacon afterwards, because it got you. And from what I understand, especially down south where they have this huge problem with them, they basically say, you know, you can kill as many as you want. Yeah. Hunters to take as many. And the meat is pretty good from what I've heard. I haven't tried it as far as I know. I mean, maybe some of the barbecue ate down there was hog. I think it would probably be labeled as such. But, you know, it seems like a good kind of hunting animal. But, yeah, they're really nasty, very, very bad creature. I mean, I would hate to have them around here. And there have been stories even in New England that people have had hogs and they've let them go. But I don't think they would survive, you know, that long around here. I mean, they're probably pretty adaptable, but it's not as widespread of a story as you'd imagine.
Cats probably finished them off. That's probably why you don't see them anymore.
Cats or the squash got them up in a tree.
I mean, that's the thing with hogs. They're not known for keeping themselves to themselves. So I think if they were there, people would realize very quickly.
Yeah, you'd notice it much more often. Like I said, I mean, seeing a hog dig through the ground looking for grubs and other bugs, I mean, it was literally like a dinosaur just came through and broke through the area. That's what it looked like.
So in regards to the upcoming film then, so how long have you got left? How much more filming have you got to do? Have you got many more interviews lined up?
I've got a few more interviews lined up. Yeah, it's been tricky. I've been doing it since, I want to say, around November is kind of when I started. And it's been a slow process. We had a pretty bad winter, very difficult to get out there and with people into their research spots. So I'm hoping to have some shoots coming up soon, you know, where we're going to go out there and kind of join the researchers. I've done a lot of sit down interviews, but I'm hoping kind of in the summer or the fall to get it out. It's sort of tentative at this point. I'm really not good with deadlines either. So I'm trying, and I'm doing a lot of other stuff as well. And I'm getting a little bit more into the writing and doing a lot more kind of blog posts about local stories. And I just wrote one up about kind of the Southern Monster trip and doing some stuff on Whitehall, New York and other areas. And I've got a lot of events too. So there's just a lot. There's a lot, like I said at the beginning of the show, everyone comes alive in the spring and there's so much going on.
Yeah, I'm extremely envious of when I see lots of people I know on Facebook going to all these conferences, and I just think, oh, I wish I was there.
It's awesome because there's so many. I mean, New England usually doesn't have that many, which is kind of most of the stuff, especially cryptid related, is out in the Midwest, you know, Ohio and those kind of places. But we've been lucky the past couple of years. There's been like a lot of interest, and obviously Lauren has his cryptozoology conference, and that's next weekend, which I'll be at. And that same weekend, I have an X-Files conference in Rhode Island on the same weekend. So I'm kind of splitting my time between them. And then I'm going out to the Ohio Bigfoot Conference for the first time, which I'm so pumped for.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant, that. There's some excellent lineups there.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. And one of the guys here from New England is one of the speakers at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference. That's John Wilk of Squatchachusetts. And it's really cool because I don't think a lot of people know about the amount of sightings that they get. And they definitely do the best research in New England. And you know, I know them. They're great guys. They're so generous. And they, you know, and everyone's welcome to their kind of outings. And they've really got a lot of interesting reports all the time. I mean, in the Facebook groups, it's like, every week there's a different report they're looking into.
Wow, brilliant. Well, it sounds like a packed schedule coming up. So after we've got the Big Cat film wrapped up, what takes your fancy next?
I think I might take a break from the documentary for just a bit. I mean, I'll always be doing little videos and like I said, YouTube stuff and that sort of thing. But I think I might be looking more into a book or something along those lines. I've been really thinking about doing something on Bigfoot in New Hampshire. I don't think anyone's really done that. Hmm. And I think there's more than a fair share of stories that are extremely unique that I've looked into that have been floating around for years. Hmm. Like I said, the structure story with the stone structure and other ones as well. I think it may be time to investigate that a little further. So That's an idea, you know. I'm still playing around with it, but one step at a time. But I tend to do this where I have one project I'm working on and I do 15 other ones at the same time. You get all these ideas in the shower and you got to get out and write it down. And it's just an overactive brain, I guess.
Brilliant. Well, listen, I wish you continued success. I'm really looking forward to the new documentary. I can't wait to see it. So where can everybody find your work, Alexander? What's the best place to find you and how can they follow you?
Yeah, the best place is on my website, which is Petakov Media. That's PETAKOV media.com. And on there, there's links to, you know, all my social media, blog posts, videos, everything you could kind of want. I have a store selling some of the documentaries and champ postcards, whatever kind of tickles your fancy. So that's the best place, Petakov Media.
Brilliant. Well, listen, all the very best. Like I say, I'm really looking forward to the film. And I just want to say thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, man. I had a really good conversation. It's always nice when you talk to someone who's so, you know, in the know about all these subjects and really fascinated about it. So thanks for having me.
Oh, you're being too kind. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. So listen, thank you again. All the best.
Thanks, Paul.